My plan in this talk was to focus on some equity distribution results, and I stick to the situation I have started with, holomorphic endomorphisms from pk to pk, degree f is d. And last time I have proved that for generic A, this converges to a measure mu, and by generic I mean that there is an exceptional set E which is algebraic, totally invariant, proper and maximal, so that when A is not in E, this implies that. So I had announced the what I'm going to do today is to prove a similar result for hypersurfaces. The method here was geometric. For hypersurfaces, I will use more pluripotential theory, but my main goal actually is to tell you somehow, okay, this works well for, in some special cases, like points, or hypersurfaces, then what to do for arbitrary codimension. And then I will introduce a tool that will help to solve this type of problems. So the theorem I'm going to sketch today, Annal-ENS, all what I'm saying is anyway joint work with Dean, I already said it. So we have f from pk to pk as above, and the conclusion of the theorem should be let H hypersurface of degree s in pk. And what I want is that f minus nh divided by dn times s converges to t. Remind you that t is the limit of fn star omega divided by dn, and here that mu was the limit of fn star omega k divided by dnk. So this is the conclusion of the theorem. And the assumption is, assume H does not contain any irreducible component of E, of the exceptional set. Let me clarify one point. For example, in dimension, you might have an exceptional set which is made of two lines. This line is exceptional and this line is exceptional. So the hypothesis say, okay, you have a hypersurface, it can cross, it will certainly cross this, but it doesn't contain this line, okay? But on the other hand, this is also an exceptional point. I want that my hypersurface doesn't contain this point, which is by itself an exceptional point. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Wait. So, I'm going to sketch the proof. So we have, when we have a current, okay, why do I go immediately to currents? Because these hypersurfaces divided by S are currents of by degree 1, 1. Okay? And of mass 1. And it's always easier to look, to work in a compactification. So the currents of B degree 1, 1 compactify, of mass 1 compactify in this convex compact set. So I take S in C1, and what I want to prove is that Fn star S divided by Dn converge to T. Well, I have an assumption on S. The assumption on S is cohomologous to omega, the Fubini Studi form, and we can write that as ddc v or u. Let me write that v for the moment, v. And the assumption is that v is not identically minus infinity on an element of E minimal. Just the same assumption. Okay, this is our goal. Well, instead of writing this this way, I prefer to write it S minus T is ddcu. After all, S also is cohomologous to T, and we have that. And U is somehow the dynamical potential, and U is determined up to constant, and I want to normalize U so that U mu is zero. This is always possible, because mu doesn't give mass to pluripolar set. It's a very good measure. Then this is possible. Hence, Fns divided by Dn, I apply Fn divided by Dn to this situation, minus T, because F star T is dt, so there is no change here, is ddc u composed with Fn divided by Dn, and it turns out that u composed with Fn divided by Dn times mu is also zero because of the total because of the invariance of mu. And then my goal now is just to prove that limit u compose Fn divided by Dn is zero. That will finish the story. It is clear since u is bounded above that lim sup of un is going to be negative. On the other hand, I have u and d mu is zero for every n. Then if you apply Fatou's lemma, you just get that lim sup of u and d mu is zero, just going on here, which means that this lim sup is zero, mu almost everywhere, and then by upper semi-continuity for any limit, then you get if I don't know how to call it, W is a limit of UN, then W equals zero on support mu. So if by chance support mu is everything, we have finished the proof. Let me just emphasize that this function U is not quasi-plurisubharmonic. But it's a plurisubharmonic function up to a continuous function. And then all the theory of plurisubharmonic functions works as well, because the problem is rather a matter of singularities rather than anything else. So, assume that this is not true, that the limit is not zero. It means that I'm going to have a limit W, which is not zero, then it's going to be less than minus 2 lambda on some open set. And by Hartog's lemma, I'm going to end up with some thing like this, that this is less than minus 2 lambda. Minus lambda, maybe. So, this, let me erase this I, because I'm not going to be too precise for the proofs. This means that this happens on some ball B. This means that U composed of Fn, with Fn, is less than minus lambda dn on some ball B. This means that U is less than minus lambda dn on Fn B. Okay. So assume this assumption is not in the theorem, but just I want to give a simple proof in the most simple case. Assume the local multiplicity is less than D. Let me just be simple, just less than D minus 1. To avoid technicalities. Then it's a consequence of Loyasiewicz inequalities that F and D is going to contain a ball of some center. I don't say that the center is the same as B, and of radius E minus a constant D minus 1 to the n. Local multiplicity at every point is less than D minus 1. Then this exceptional set is empty. Okay. Then there is something important that I will try to keep for when I will deal with superpotential. There is this remarkable estimate, compacity estimate, for plurisubharmonic functions. When you have a plurisubharmonic function, say just on the unit disk or on a ball, then there is an alpha so that this is bounded. And it's uniformly bounded on any compact family of pluri or subharmonic functions. Then the proof is going to be this. I know that E alpha U omega k is less than a constant, finite. On the other hand, this is larger than F and D, E alpha U. But on F and B, this U is larger than E lambda to the dn. And F and B contains a ball of this radius. D minus 1 n. This is a contradiction. And that finishes the proof in this case. This argument, this is what we proved for Ness and I think in 92. So the argument is very simple and shows what type of tools we have to use. Now the situation is quite different because the fact that the multiplicity is like that doesn't always hold, because in general what happens is that FB contains a ball of radius d to the n rather than anything else. And you cannot improve this estimate. So the way to deal with that is something like this. If we are going to consider somehow G prime, all the limits of U composed with Fn divided by Dn, all the possible limits of this, it's a compact family. And we are going to construct a sequence of limits, taking limits again, so that Vn plus 1 is 1 over D Vn composed with F. This is obtained just by extracting limits, etc. So you construct some sort of compact family of limits. And it turns out that in this estimate, so the problem is to prove that all these guys are zero. It turns out that you get the same type of contradiction here with U replaced with Vn. And you can improve this estimate by taking alpha larger if the Lulon number are close to zero, are small. So the idea is that if one of these limits is not zero, we are going to get a function, a family of functions like that, and the Lulon numbers somewhere are going to be large. Large meaning strictly larger than a constant, that's it. The idea is basically this. We have this exceptional set E. We start first with the exceptional points. Okay? The hypothesis tells us that U compose Fn divided by Dn converge to zero at the exceptional points, because U is not minus infinity there, and then U converge to zero. Okay? Then there is an induction argument. We take a branch possibly containing this exceptional set, and we are going to do the analysis on that branch. It's an induction argument on the dimension of the irreducible component of the exceptional set E. The last step, after proving convergence on the exceptional set E, then we prove convergence on the complement to zero, and that's it. So the idea is basically this, that we have constructed this sequence of functions, and the Lulun number are large at some point A. The point is this result of SU, as I already mentioned, then the set of Lulun, where the Lulun number of a current is larger than a constant, this is an analytic set. But then, it turns out that you can refine a lot this statement, and not only analyze, not only say that this set is analytic, but also that you can analyze the components VR of, say, of dimension R, where this Lulun number is larger than C over 2, for example. Some is larger than C or 2C or whatever. You can analyze the component of where this Lulun number is larger than 2C. And that was done by Demailly-Méo. And what they call that an inequality on self-intersection of currents. And basically the inequality is something like that. If you have a current, then you look at the degrees we are in PK, so this analytic set come with a degree. Okay? You look at the degrees on which the Lulun number is large, some power P minus Q or whatever, and you claim that this sum is bounded. In some sense, when you have a current, the analytic varieties where the Lulun number is large cannot be of too high degree because of this bound. So our goal is to construct varieties on which the Lulun of high degree, on which the Lulun number is too large. And that will contradict that inequality of Demailly-Méo and give the result. The problem is the following. In principle, when you take a variety and you take the preimage, but here we are going to take preimages. We have this family of equations. Then we will control the Lulun numbers when we take preimages. There are good inequalities for that. Problem is this, when you take, suppose I have a variety and I know the Lulun number is larger there and I want to increase the degrees and I take preimages, the degree is going to increase, I am finished. But the problem is not so, because I can just take z equals z squared w squared, take z equals zero, I take preimages, the degree of the variety is not going to change, then we are in trouble. This is where the induction argument comes. When I am in this variety, I'm not in the exceptional point here, with respect to the variety, then I analyze the Lulun numbers here and take preimages that will increase, because I have, since I'm not on the exception, imagine I'm just at the last step. I'm out of the exceptional set. And when I take preimages, the degree is just multiplied properly because you can count the degree by taking the intersection with subspaces of the right dimension. So it's always counting the number of preimages and we are out of the exceptional set, we have the right number of pre-images. Okay? But we have to do that relatively to each irreducible component of E. So we have to do first the analysis on analytic sets with singularities, possibly. Okay. Once we do this, basically the argument is we construct enough varieties so that the degree increases when we take pre-images, and at the end we will contradict this inequality. So, first part, you see, was quite straightforward and simple. Second part uses heavily, at least implicitly, Hollmander self-estimates, because all this business relies on prism. This is just for 1-1 current. Sorry, no, the Maillet is for every PP current. Yeah, no, sorry. But the main point is 1-1, actually. The rest is just small technology. Okay. So that's the approach. So the theorem I want to state now is the following. There is an open Zariski-Dent set I can describe it actually precisely. It's just the local multiplicity is less than D. So in some sense, we are able to do the first part for the moment. So that when S is a positive closed current of B degree PP mass 1, Fn star S divided by dnp minus t applied to a test form phi, this is less than 1 over lambda n C alpha norm of phi. For example, as I said, for points I will get that Fn star delta I dnk minus mu phi is less than 1 lambda n phi phi alpha. Okay, this is a problem. Thank you. T to the power p. Thank you. To be honest with you, I'm not that interested in the theorem, because the problem is rather how to compute with varieties of currents of B degree PP. So I'm taking as an excuse the equidistributional results to deal with this type of questions. Let's analyze it. S now, hopefully the blackboard is still here. S is now a PP current of mass 1. So it's cohomologous to omega p, and I can certainly write that as ddcu for some p minus 1 form, And there are even explicit formulas with good estimates to do that, though they are difficult to find, in my opinion. Apparently, the right formula is due to Gaber, and was used by Borst, Gillet, Soulet, precisely for arithmetic purpose. But what is important here are two things. That U is negative, that's precisely possible because we are in PK. Or U bounded above, that's the point. The problem is U is not unique. I can add any dv plus d bar v. This doesn't change that it still satisfies this equation. So, in some sense, it's not canonical. And taking wedge products becomes a problem. For B degree 1-1, the advantage of quasi-pluri subharmonic functions or whatever is that they are defined everywhere. Here, U is going to be L1 or L1 plus epsilon, so it will be difficult to say what means dz1, dz1 bar minus infinity plus infinity dz2, dz2 bar. We won't know how to handle these guys. So there are several difficulties, and I'm going to be rather intuitive. I'm just trying to introduce the theory, which is long and will appear in ACTA this year, I hope. And the point is this. Let me be a little come back to B degree 1-1. Then I have S minus omega is DDCU. This means I can give a value to U at every point X. Instead of considering that U is a function on PK, I prefer to consider that U is a function on probability measures. To a probability measure mu, it goes to U d mu. This is a little pedantic in this case because we didn't gain anything. If we replace mu by a Dirac match, we have ux, and if we know ux, we know u or d nu, because we are always able to integrate upper semi-continuous functions. Possibly they will have the value minus infinity, but we are used to that. The advantage, however, is that I can expand this point of view to higher B degree. I'm going to consider that the superpotential of S is going to be a function defined on CK minus P plus 1 with values in minus infinity plus infinity. When P equal 1, I just find the probability measures. Let me remind you that CR are the positive current of mass 1 closed and B degree RR. And I'm going to define this function. Okay? So for the moment, assume S smooth. Then I'm going to say what is USR. I have a U here, and they can normalize so that US wedge omega k minus p plus 1 is 0. That's easy. So let me fix such a quasi-potential, I can fix it smooth, then this makes sense. It's US applied to R. Okay? Since I have, this is a definition. I didn't gain much apparently because my problem was it depend on U, but now it's going to depend on U again here. But this is R minus omega minus K minus P plus 1 because of my normalization. And this is US ddc vr. And I can normalize also the solution of vr in the way I'm going to use. Then Stokes' theorem tells me this is ddc us vr. And this is what? This is s minus omega p vr. And suppose I have normalized so that omega p vr is 0, then I get svr. So finally, this didn't depend on us, because it's equal to svr. Well, but here to give a meaning to this computation, I had basically I proved also that this is also VR applied to S in some sense. I have UR applied to S with obvious notations. But to give so I could have instead supposed that R is smooth instead of S smooth. A reasonable way to define this, I want this to be defined for every R, not just for R smooth, would be to say that it's the Lin sup when R prime converges to R of U S R prime. And then say this, yes. Not clear to me. It's not clear to me, but maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Okay, so I can ask this, but then I lost a lot of things. I lost, for example, that it's affine with respect to R and with respect to S. It's not a good definition. So the way to handle that, at the end is going to be this, actually. The end is going to be this. The point is now that these functions are defined on a compact space, but it's a compact space with not enough structure. So we have to put some structure on it. We can make out of it a good metric space, but I'm not going to tell you the metric. What I'm going to tell is rather some geometry on this space. That means we are going to decide of some privileged paths that are going to give us somewhere compacity estimates. And the idea is classical and comes, a special example of R would be a cycle. the cycle would be an R. So the problem is, how do you travel from one cycle to another? Okay? And the answer that the geometers have for long is, well, take a cycle with one more dimension, and the two cycles appear as a section of this larger dimension cycle. Okay? So this is how it works. We are going to consider a current. So this is a current of dimension P minus 1. We consider a current on, say, the unit disk cross PK, R, which is positive, closed, and such that the slices, I will restrict actually to currents whose slices are defined everywhere and are continuous. So I can take slices, and this will give me K minus P currents. Okay? And it turns out that the functions I'm going to consider will be some functions like U theta. Theta is the parameter in the disk. It will be U S R theta. So I'm going to arrange that the R theta are smooth when theta is different from zero. R0 is not smooth, but I can travel, I mean PK, using smooth current from one to another. And also, there is a curvature condition, which is basically, I want that P delta star R wedge, I believe in this case should be omega P, this is the alpha, a smooth form. So we call these guys special structural disks. It means, yeah. This is a 1-1 form. So it is possible to travel from one current to another using a smoothing, because we are in the projective space, it's homogeneous. We can construct object like that to travel through smooth currents. And basically, USR is going to be the limit when theta goes to zero of U theta. The problem is why such a limit exists and why it does not depend on R. Well, we like pluralist subharmonic functions, so the reason is going to hinge in pluralist subharmonicity or just subharmonicity. DDCU theta is what? Is P delta of R wedge DDCUS. Because U is, And the DDCUS is larger than minus omega P. Because DDCUS is S minus omega P. This is larger than minus omega P. So this is larger than P delta R omega P. This is minus alpha, which is smooth. So this function appears as a quasi pluris subharmonic function out of the origin. And then we are going to have limits when theta goes to zero, especially if we do our smoothing properly. That's the idea. Always, when we want to prove something, we always go to structural disks, build subharmonic functions or quasi-subharmonic functions, and use compacity estimate there. Okay? The amazing thing is that everything works. What I mean by this is just the following. This function US are defined on CK minus P plus 1 with value in minus infinity plus infinity. And they have just exactly all the properties of quasi-pluris subharmonic functions. All exactly the same. That means you have a Hartog theorem. You have a result telling you that given S, there are Sn smooth, so that USn decreases to US. Hartogs means that if lim sup of USn is less strictly than a continuous function, then for n large enough, USn is less than that continuous function. So all the tools I was using for my small proof I started with are available here. Well, the formal ones at least. There is still one important tool. One of the important tools I used was this, E minus alpha U is less than a constant for quasi-pluris subharmonic function. Okay? This was crucial. But we can replace that, and I give you just the weak form. The estimate is just this, USR is less than a constant 1 log plus R infinity. If R is a bounded form, it has a subnorm, there is a constant independent of R, okay? So that you have this inequality, and this gives exactly the compacity estimates to replace this one. And actually, to be honest with you, this is proved using that one. Because you assume it's not true, then you have somewhere it's not true, you construct a structural disk and find the contradiction with this. That's it.
Back up a little bit. Why didn't it depend on the choice of the structural disk? Did you say that?
No. No, I didn't say that, because at the end, what we prove is that choose a structural disk, and then this value is exactly this. So after the fact, it's just independent of the structural disk. Oh, okay. There is always in any place a blackboard that doesn't work. So I'm not really developing the theory because it has many directions. I just want to sketch how it works to prove this equidistributional result. Well, as before, I can introduce this dynamical superpotential, which is Us minus Utp, Tp is the green current to the power p, minus a constant S, and the constant is chosen so that as it's a normalization, like with my measure mu, Pk minus p plus 1 equals 0. And corresponding to that, you have, if I were to solve S minus omega p equals something, the quasi-potential will be Us. Here I think I call it Utp. And to keep the normalization, the constant has changed and call it M. Omega p minus 1. And V, and then let me call that Vs. And basically Vs R is Vs applied to R. Okay? And what we want to prove, I didn't say it, but it's so obvious. If two superpotentials coincide, then the corresponding currents are coincide. So if I want to prove something converge to zero, then I just prove the superpotential converge to zero. So what I'm after is proving that V, L, and S converge to zero. And it's enough, indeed, to show that it converges to zero for R smooth, because R, this determines the, all the limits. There is a useful formula, which is VL and S is 1 over dn V lambda n R. Let me remind you that L is F star divided by dp, and lambda is F star divided by dp minus 1. This is just an adjoint formula to go from one to the other. That's not difficult. And so the problem is to prove that this goes to zero. We are apparently in good shape because this is 1 over dn, so it's not bad. What we know is that the Lim sup, for the same reason as before, VLNS is negative. Then the trouble starts here. And this is basically the trouble I want to explain to you, is V lambda NR. So this is, let me say R0 equal R. This is 1 over dn minus 1, V lambda n minus 1 S applied to lambda R0. Problem is I cannot do any estimate. Why? Because when this is a function, F star below preserve continuity. If I start with a continuous function, it doesn't preserve smoothness, but at least it preserves boundedness. When I have a current, there are critical value, P, set of critical values. F star of a smooth form is not smooth. It's not anymore, it's not even bounded because you have the inverse of the Jacobian basically popping up, and then that's it. We cannot go do any estimates. Our trick, I hope I didn't erase it. Oh no, too bad I erased it. Our only estimate we can use was the following, that USR we need bounded forms to play with this estimate, which is equivalent to the exponential estimate. Hence, we are somehow in trouble, but the point is this, what we do is, with obvious notation, I start here, and I write this as d minus 1, vn minus 1, lambda r0, but then I smooth lambda r0, and I get a current r1. R1 is lambda r0. Smoothing of this one using the automorphism group of PK. Plus d minus 1, vn minus 1, r1. Okay? Then, but when you smooth, this increases dramatically if you smooth something bounded, not bounded, if you smooth it. This is going to increase dramatically this one here, the uniform norm. It's not going to be bounded. Then you have to, but you have a control of the uniform norm, choose a small neighborhood of P1, and but in the complement of that small neighborhood, you control the uniform norm. It's big, but you control it. Okay? It's not too bad because you have this d minus n here in reserve. Okay? So you are allowed to increase something, and to show that first the first step is to show that this integral, I can take out the critical values and it is exactly the same. And that's really a delicate lemma to prove that this is the case. Then once you do that, you can smooth things, and basically the end of the smooth at each step and repeat. Put a 1 over d, this is vn minus 2, lambda r1, and repeat the construction. Smooth every element, estimate properly, and prove convergence. And this is the way that you get these speeds of convergence here. Okay? So, in principle, the method should be the right one because it gives good estimates. There are so far some technical difficulties to carry it on when there is an exceptional set. because here the Zariski open set is just the one where the local multiplicity is less than D. Exactly. That was the easy case that I treated first. But to deal with this, with the critical, with the exceptional set, well, we need still to prove some estimates. The last thing I want to say is that, well, I took somehow, as I told you, as an excuse, this theorem, but the fact that to have a reasonable theory how to deal with currents of B degree PP or to compute with them gives you an amazingly simple theory of intersection of currents. This means that you can wedge P1, P1, P2, P2 with only something similar than in for B degree 1-1, that you ask just the potential of R1 to be integrable with R, with respect to R2, and that's it. And the condition is not more than that, and you have associativity, commutativity, and all sort of things that are, that you wish to have when you compute. Also, yeah. We have a notion of Hartog's convergence that it's not decreasing. It's more there is a notion of Hartog's convergence that is even better in B degree 1-1. Okay, so let me stop here.